It is absolutely unacceptable to see violence against people.
Myanmar deaths condemned while trial begins for a high-profile death last year. It's Tuesday, March 30th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us online. We're at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, royal defamation on trial in Thailand. Concerned Afghan female journalists finding vaccinations. Muslim politics. Me Too in the movies. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Taiwan's Myanmar community came out in force to protest the continued crackdown in that country following the military coup on February 1st. Gathered beside Taipei's Liberty Square, demonstrators sat for hours singing songs, holding anti-coup posters, and waving the flag of Myanmar. Even younger demonstrators banged pots and pans as a form of protest, as seen within the embattled country. Estimates for numbers in attendance have ranged from 1,000 to 3,000, according to student organizers and event volunteers. A week earlier, a similar rally at the plaza in Taiwan took place. Taiwan is a self-ruled democracy that is home to a population of more than 23 million, with 40,000 people reportedly from Myanmar originally. Meanwhile, at the United Nations, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the escalation of violence.
What has happened in the National Day of the Armed Forces was absolutely horrendous. And I had the occasion to vigorously condemn it and to say that it is absolutely unacceptable to see violence against people at such high levels, so many people killed, and such a stubborn refusal to accept the need to liberate all political prisoners and to make the country go back to a serious democratic transition. The past system was not perfect, you know. There's no comparison with the present situation. I mean, we need more unity in the international community, with more commitment in the international community to put pressure in order to make sure that the situation is reversed.
Secretary General Guterres reiterated his message to Myanmar military generals.
My message to the military is very simple. Stop the killings. Stop the repression of the demonstrations. Release the political prisoners and return power to those that have the legitimate right to exercise it.
On Sunday, the United Nations reported that over 107 people were killed the day before by Myanmar's military in their ongoing brutal efforts to crack down on a widespread and committed opposition movement. A non-profit monitoring organization, the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners, reported on the 28th that over 2,500 people are currently in detention and 459 have been killed. Elsewhere, one death last year reverberated around the world, and the police officer involved is now on trial. A racially mixed jury in Minneapolis, Minnesota, will decide the fate of a white former police officer in the death of an African-American, George Floyd. Video showing former officer Derek Chauvin as he knelt on Floyd's neck for nearly 8 minutes sparked protests around the world and was played during opening arguments in court Monday. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan reports the world is watching as the trial gets underway.
Jurors will decide the guilt or innocence of Derek Chauvin on counts of second and third degree murder and second degree manslaughter. Floyd's death last May sparked both peaceful vigils and violent demonstrations, with people of all backgrounds joining protests from Minneapolis to Washington, D.C., and hundreds of other cities around the world.
He watched the life go out of him. And so because people watched a man die on video and on the news and on social media uploads, it rallied the world to attention to the cause of police violence against African Americans.
The trial is about the death of one man and one man's guilt or innocence, but raises more fundamental questions, says another analyst.
How much of a democracy is this country? How much do African Americans count? And, you know, more fundamentally, lowercase letters, do Black Lives Matter in America?
He says too often police mistreat black people with impunity. The defense hopes to argue Floyd's drug use contributed to his death. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison pursued the case aggressively and will prosecute it. Phillips says politicians must address the issues of inequality and police behavior at the heart of the case.
And so whatever the result is, the political leadership stepping forward and passing meaningful reform policies will do a lot.
Earlier this month, Minneapolis city officials approved a $27 million civil settlement with Floyd's family. Now the issue is in the hands of a criminal court as a tense city and nation await a verdict in a trial expected to last from 2 to 4 weeks. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News.
These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Australia cuts pandemic wage subsidy as Brisbane enters new lockdown. Massive fire at Indonesia oil refinery. Bangladeshi protesters clash with police during strike. Public outcry in Indonesia over mandatory hijab for non-Muslim students. Wary of Beijing, Taiwan doubles down on South China Sea Island. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and our website, voanews.com. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Let's continue with VOA Asia. As Thailand's youth-led pro-democracy protesters are battered by rounds of legal charges, a teenager is facing up to 15 years in jail under the country's hardline royal defamation law. His crime is wearing a crop top, allegedly mocking Thailand's king. Vijitcha Duangdi in Bangkok reports.
The 16-year-old faces jail time for allegedly mocking Thailand's monarchy, headed by King Mahavishnu. He is only a teenager, but to his critics, he is an enemy of the state. His crime? Wearing a crop top similar to the 68-year-old king's own fashion choice, captured on camera in Germany. Now he faces up to 15 years in jail for alleged royal defamation, better known as Section 112 of the Thai Criminal Code.
I'm okay with being called a nation hater, but I want to tell those who call me such names that I am fighting to make our country better, so that all of you who are calling me names will also have a better life.
Thailand is a bitterly divided kingdom. Many young pro-democracy protesters want the army-linked government to fall and the monarchy's powers curbed under a new constitution. They also want the 112 law scrapped. But royalists believe King Vajiralongkorn and the palace should not be dragged into the public debate. They say the law is necessary to protect the monarchy. The young protester wants all Thais to be treated equally despite their opinions. But with over 70 pro-democracy activists charged with royal defamation, the state is smothering the movement.
I'm scared that others will end up like me. I'm worried this will be a reason people don't want to come out and protest anymore.
The royal defamation law carries between 3 and 15 years of jail time per conviction for criticizing, defaming, or threatening the country's royals. The crowds who mobbed Bangkok streets night after night last year come out less frequently now. And that has left their leaders more vulnerable to legal action. Several have been held pending trial for 112.
Criminal punishment is meant for those who commit a violent crime. Speaking or dressing a certain way is neither a violent crime nor immoral. This shows that freedom of expression in this country is so low, it's almost non-existent.
Last month, the United Nations condemned the rising use of the law. Thai critics of 112, like famous graffiti artist Hedek Stencil, say complaints are being misused, making anyone a potential target.
This law is not being used by the people that this law was designed to protect. It's currently being used virtually by anyone.
On Monday, the teen rebel is set to find out if his case will go to trial. An increasingly high price is being paid by young protesters calling for change. Wichitra Dungdi, VOA News, Bangkok.
Happening now in Asia, family and friends of those killed in Myanmar's bloodiest day since protests against the country's military coup began held funerals Monday. An estimated 114 people across Myanmar were killed Saturday as security forces opened fire on protesters. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's nice to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Female journalists in Afghanistan are concerned about their safety after three women working for a media outlet in the eastern Afghan city of Jalalabad were killed in an early March attack claimed by the Islamic State. VOA's Lima Niazi has the story narrated by Roshan Norzai.
Female journalists in Afghanistan are expressing alarm following an attack in early March claimed by Islamic State that killed three women working for Incas TV in Jalalabad city. Journalists say they believe the killings are aimed at silencing the voices of women. Journalist Mina Habib, who survived an attack in Kabul several months ago, wants the Afghan government to do more.
I request the government to provide security for journalists. Journalists work as a bridge between the government and the public. Killing Malala and other journalists will not stop us from doing our job.
According to the Afghan media organization, NAI, at least 11 Afghan journalists and media workers were killed in 2020. The Afghan Journalists Safety Committee estimates the number of women in media has decreased by 18% because of deteriorating security.
Female journalists are concerned about their future, work safety, and that families do not let their children, particularly girls, work in media.
The uptick in violence against journalists comes as the Afghan government is negotiating with the Taliban to end the long-running war in Afghanistan. Women fear that any power-sharing arrangement with the Taliban will threaten their hard-gained rights and freedoms. Afghan government officials downplay that concern.
Women have had many achievements in the last 19 years. Their presence in politics, government, culture, society, and economy is one of the major discussion points in the peace talks. It is a red line for the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan.
So far, no progress has been reported in intra-Afghan peace talks that began on September 12th in Qatar's capital, Doha. For Lima Niazi in Kabul, Afghanistan, Roshan Norzai, VOA News.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. Police found explosives in a raid in the city of Bekasi related to Sunday's suicide attack on a cathedral on Sulawesi Island in Indonesia. Two suspected suicide bombers blew themselves up when intercepted by security at the gate to the church compound. You'll find this and many more stories on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue with VOA Asia. Almost by chance, a group of eight high school teachers created a plan to use their technological and organizational skills to help people get their COVID vaccines. VOA News reporter Christina Saicedo-Smith has the story.
Sitting at the benches of a football field at the school where some of them used to teach Spanish class, the vaccine hunters, as they call their group, are meeting in person. It's something they haven't done for a while. They have been helping people in their community get their COVID vaccines.
My children's piano teacher, she's in her 80s. She lives in Washington, D.C. She couldn't find an appointment. And when I helped her, I realized I wanted to help more people. And that's when my friend Maisie Lynch texted me and said, would you want to help me watch some websites?
This group of all women educators noticed that many people eligible for the COVID vaccine were having trouble finding appointments and navigating the various COVID websites.
Just said, hey, can you help me get some appointments for people? You know, people are asking and I just need some help. And they were like, sure. And it's grown tremendously. Really quickly, we found out that a lot of people needed our help. We made a Facebook page. We had a spreadsheet we were sending out to people.
Technology, internet access, and speed are some of the things the vaccine hunters say are needed to get the COVID vaccine appointments.
The website has a time that if you don't register within that certain time, maybe someone who is faster on the keyboard will take the appointment.
Maria Peterson is a high school Spanish teacher. After confirming appointments for hundreds of people, she noticed that only certain parts of the population were asking for help and getting vaccinated.
We noticed that there was only a big group of white and upper middle class people who were asking for help. We realized that the Latino and African American community was not getting vaccinated.
Members of the vaccine hunters say many in minority communities are worried about the vaccine safety.
People are very afraid because of their immigration status. They think they need to have documents. This is a pandemic, and it is a public health problem, and the government wants everyone to receive their vaccine.
Despite the challenges, the group have managed to help 1,000 people get their vaccines. They have a Facebook space open to conversation and information about COVID vaccines in their state of Maryland. They say they've learned many lessons and are grateful to help a community that has also supported them. Cristina Quecedo Smith, VOA News, Washington.
Making headlines in Asia, more than 900 people from a nearby village were evacuated after a massive fire broke out at an oil refinery in West Java, Indonesia. The cause of the fire is not known, although the blaze started during a lightning storm. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, Muslims are gaining political voice in the United States as they voted in record numbers in the 2020 presidential election, with well over 60% casting their votes for now President Joe Biden. Some now wish to see more Muslims in the White House. VOA's Yuni Salem spoke to some American Muslims in this report, narrated by Nova Pirwadi.
The Biden administration has been touted as the most diverse cabinet in U.S. history. This and President Joe Biden's reversal of the travel restrictions mostly affecting Muslim-majority nations has earned praise from Muslim advocacy groups. But some wish the president had gone further.
What we're looking for President Biden to do and to work with the Muslim community is certainly more inclusion, more appointment in his administration, utilize the talented, energetic, with experienced American Muslims to be in his administration.
The U.S. Constitution forbids selection or disqualification from public office based on someone's religious background. But this representation matters to many Muslims, including Abrar Omeish, a Libyan-American in Fairfax, in the U.S. state of Virginia.
I will be honest. I was hoping to see a little bit more, not just in terms of individuals and leadership, but you know, he currently is proud to have the most diverse cabinet that we've ever seen in the country's history, but there's not a single person representing the Muslim community.
Muslims have been appointed to lower level positions, including Pakistani American Ali Zaidi as First Deputy White House National Climate Advisor, Bangladeshi American Zain Siddiq as Senior Advisor to the White House Deputy Chief of Staff, and Palestinian-American Rima Dodin as Deputy Director of the White House Office of Legislative Affairs. While the executive branch still does not have a senior-level Muslim cabinet member, Congress is beginning to reflect America's religious makeup. There are three members of the House of Representatives who are Muslim out of 435. For Yuni Salim in Washington, I'm Nova Purwadi, VOA News.
Allen vs. Pharaoh is a four-part documentary by Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering, focusing on Dylan Farrow's accusation that her famous filmmaker father, Woody Allen, sexually abused her. Woody Allen denounces the allegations. The film is the latest in a series of exposés on sexual abuse by powerful men against women in the Me Too era. VOA's Penelope Plou spoke with the filmmakers and shares the story.
This is the story of two of the biggest stars in the world.
The father is Woody Allen, writer, director, actor. The mother is Mia Farrow, his co-star and mother of his three children.
Mia reportedly has a video of their daughter Dylan explaining how Allen molested her.
In HBO's documentary series Allen v. Farrow, filmmakers Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering chronicle Dylan Farrow's allegations that her father molested her at the age of 7.
We have put forward a four-part series with evidence, with eyewitnesses, with corroboration, with testimony, with police reports, with drawings and diagrams. I mean, this is not something we spun or yarned.
According to the documentary, Dylan Farrow's molestation allegations were central in the custody battle between Woody Allen and Mia Farrow in the New York State Court in 1992. Though the court ruled in favor of Mia Farrow, Allen was never prosecuted for sexual abuse. Speaking to the filmmakers, Dylan Farrow says throughout her life, her personal accounts have been eclipsed by the star power of her very famous father. Dylan says she still lives with the trauma of abuse.
I mean, I worshipped him. He was so funny, and he made me feel so special. That's where things get really, really complicated. Because threaded throughout all of those good times, there was a lot more going on.
According to The Hollywood Reporter, Allen has fired back at the filmmakers, calling Allen v. Farrow a hatchet job for omitting his perspective. The filmmakers told VOA that Allen declined to be interviewed.
We would have welcomed an interview with him. If I were him and I really had wanted, I would absolutely talk to everybody if I felt that there was a grave injustice being done.
Cynthia Fuchs, who heads the film department at George Mason University, says in recent years there has been a number of investigative documentaries that revisit decades-long public allegations of sexual abuse by powerful people.
I do think that that's part of what the documentaries are doing now. They are picking up cases that have been repressed or have been suppressed, I should say. And in that sense, they're important.
A good example, she says, are Kirby Dick's and Amy Ziering's previous exposés. The 2012 Oscar-nominated documentary, The Invisible War, about systemic rape of women in the military, was watched at the time by members of Congress and Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, who subsequently made policy changes of rape prosecution in the military. The pair's 2015 Oscar-nominated film, The Hunting Ground, opened up the conversation of sexual assault on college campuses. More recently, Fuchs says, the documentary Surviving R. Kelly, which features a number of women making allegations of abuse against the famous musician, Robert Kelly, prompted investigations of Kelly, who now faces sex-related charges. The documentary Untouchable, The Rise and Fall of Harvey Weinstein, renewed the Harvey Weinstein sexual abuse allegations. The disgraced film producer has been sentenced to 23 years in prison for rape and sexual assault.
I'm all for consequences culture. This movement to have people more accountable for their actions, I think, is a really good and healthy one.
Kirby Dick says documentaries on sexual abuse, such as Allen v. Farrow and others, are informing the hashtag MeToo movement.
It gives solace. It gives support to other survivors who may or may not choose to speak up, adults and children.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Continue with us online at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our team, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day ahead. Be safe. Be well.